our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Washington man has received a two-day jail term for threatening to kill a black state trooper.
An abortion rights group has submitted petitions with more than twice the number of signatures needed to ask voters to repeal the state's sweeping abortion ban.
Military investigators have determined that U.S. Marines wantonly killed unarmed Iraqi civilians, including women and children, in the city of Hadati last November.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,468 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 42,444 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true Iraq body count may be as high as 250,000 dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 30th, 2006. I'm Josonia Watson.
And I'm Doug Guidi. A U.S. Army field medic from Estacada, Jeremy Loveless, has been killed in Iraq near Mosul. Loveless, age 25, had held different jobs in the Estacada area and was training to become a paramedic in civilian life, said his mother-in-law. Loveless leaves a wife, Melissa, and a daughter, Shiloh, 4. There were few details Tuesday morning, including when the death occurred. Loveless was a volunteer firefighter for the Estacada Fire Department. Department member Steve Fritz said Loveless joined the Army to get medical training. Fritz says the firefighters at the department had just sent Loveless a care package, but that he was killed before receiving it. Loveless was the 61st person from Oregon or with close Oregon ties to die in Iraq or Afghanistan.
A Washington man received a two-day jail term last week for threatening to kill a black state trooper. The McMinnville News Register reports that the man was also found to have called the officer a racial epithet and making numerous racist comments. Manuel Thomas Diaz of Vancouver was sentenced to 2 days of jail time, 2 years of probation, 100 hours of community service, and a $100 fine after pleading guilty to one count of second-degree intimidation. Facing Judge Cal Titchener in court last week, Diaz was apologetic after learning he would go to jail. He became abusive in court. I think it's sad you're sending me to jail, Diaz said Titchener, who ignored him. Diaz continued to mutter about the jail time, but failed to raise the judge's interest. Then he stormed from the courtroom, leaving his ex-wife behind to maneuver her wheelchair through the heavy double door on her own.
A driver struck and killed two bicyclists Monday on Highway 47 south of Forest Grove, the authorities said. The victims were Daryl McDaniel, 65, and Cheryl McDaniel, 61, both of Forest Grove, said Sergeant David Thompson of the Washington County Sheriff's Office. The motorist, whose name has also not been released, was not injured. Thompson said the cyclists were riding on the shoulder of the road when the car hit them. He said investigators do not think alcohol was a factor. The deaths brought to 8 the number of people in the state who lost their lives in traffic crashes over the Memorial Day weekend, the Oregon State Police said.
The federal government says to better prepare students for challenges of the 21st century, students nationwide should become fluent in Arabic, Chinese, Russian, and Korean. However, the most commonly offered languages in Oregon classrooms include French, German, and Spanish. A lack of funding and qualified teachers often leaves foreign language programs taking a back seat to other educational agendas in Oregon and elsewhere. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, about 44% of high schoolers in 2000 took a foreign language. Of those, 69% took Spanish and 18% took French. Fewer than 1% combined studied Arabic, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Russian. Most states, including Oregon, don't require foreign language study to graduate from high school.
Ballots went into the mail Friday on the proposed recall of Wilhelmina's Mayor Rita Baller and councilors Teresa Hibden and Rose Wright. The recall effort is being led by Paul Delaney. He was motivated mainly by two council actions earlier this year, eviction of the popular library cat, AG, since reversed, and dismissal of city recorder Lorelei Wright, bounced on a 3-2 vote. Delaney says the city's officials acted with no agenda listing or other public notice, no opportunity for public comment, discussion or involvement, and no meaningful discussion among the councilors themselves. The recall petitions accuse the officials of ignoring petitions presenting on behalf of AG the cat, misusing and mishandling city funds, holding meetings for questionable reasons, abusing city employees, dismissing key high-skill staff members without giving sufficient thought of their replacement, an apparent reference to Wright, and more. The three have refused to resign, vowing a fight for the right to complete their terms. Ballard's expires December 31st, but the other two run through the end of 2008.
In Washington State, a recall effort has been launched against White Salmon Mayor Roger Holen. Holen has been under fire since January when he removed Richard Cortez as chief of the Bingen White Salmon Police Department and replaced him with the department's second-ranking officer, Sergeant Bruce Brending. Holen said he made the move because he believed that Brending, who had served as a White Salmon police officer for 20 years, was more qualified to be chief. The move angered many in the small community who saw Cortez's removal as unjust. In their legal filing, recall proponents presented five claims against Holen. And in an opinion issued May 12th, a Yakima County Superior Court ruled there was sufficient factual and legal basis for the recall to go forward on the five separate charges.
Howard Dean says Democrats must have faith in their ability to attract religious voters. The former presidential candidate will speak at next weekend's Oregon Democratic Convention in Eugene. Dean says his party must do a better job of winning the support of evangelical Christians who have voted Republican in recent elections. To that end, Dean recently appeared on Pat Robertson's 700 Club, but the appearance wasn't without its bumps. Dean had to later apologize to gay rights leaders for incorrectly stating during the program that the party's platform said marriage is between a man and a woman. Dean says Democratic values are American values, but the executive director of the Oregon Republican Party says Democrats are so out of step with religious voters that the approach has little chance of working.
The western snowy plover has been making a comeback on the Oregon coast, but is still considered to be a threatened species. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants public comments to consider delisting the bird in certain areas where numbers have increased. KBOO's Stephanie Potter has more.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is planning a meeting in Coos Bay next week to discuss a proposed rule regarding the western snowy plover. The tiny shorebird, which breeds on coastal beaches, has seen a loss of its nesting habitat from human disturbance and predators. The birds have been listed as threatened since 1993.
We don't have any plovers nesting north of Lane County at all right now.
That was Laura Todd of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
There are some areas in Oregon and Washington that are doing fairly well. They haven't quite met their management goals, but they're getting close.
Protection measures have included rope enclosures around the nests, removal of predators, and habitat restoration. A 2005 survey estimated that in the U.S., the western snowy plover population is about 2,300, and Todd said the nesting pairs in Oregon have increased significantly in the last 10 years.
From 93, we went from 55 birds breeding, and in 2004, we had 120 birds breeding.
Because of this progress, the Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed a new rule which would allow some incidental loss of western snowy plovers in counties that meet breeding bird management goals. The hope is that counties would have more incentive to develop plans to meet recovery goals and that the service could focus its resources on the counties with the greatest need. Next Tuesday, June 6th, there will be a meeting at the public library in Coos Bay from 6 to 8 p.m. The agency is seeking information and comment from the public. Their website is www.fws.gov/OregonFWO, and Laura Todd is in their Newport office. The comments are due in August. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
A retiree from Bend is leading the campaign to put Oregon's term limits law back on the November ballot. Voters passed such a law in 1992, but was overturned by the state Supreme Court a decade later. Chief Petitioner Ted Berthelot says the power of incumbency is preventing new blood with fresh ideas from going to the Capitol. Opponents of term limits say the law would drain the legislature of needed experience. Constitutional amendments require a little more 100,000 valid signatures to qualify for the ballot. Berthelot says won't say many signatures he's got, but vows to get enough. Efforts by others to put a term limits revival onto the ballot in 2002 and 2004 fizzled because of a lack of support.
The U.S. Supreme Court says it will decide if tobacco giant Philip Morris must pay nearly $80 million in damages to a longtime Oregon smoker. It's a case that could shield companies from large jury awards. The Oregon Supreme Court had ruled that the amount wasn't excessive given the extraordinarily reprehensible conduct of Philip Morris in marketing cigarettes. A jury had ordered damages be paid to the family of Jesse Williams, a janitor who smoked three packs of Marlboros a day before he died in 1997 of lung cancer. Williams took up cigarettes in the 1950s while serving in the Army in Korea. Philip Morris lawyers say that the Oregon Supreme Court decision is dangerous.
Parents in Seattle aren't sure the school's district controversial school closure plan is going to save enough money to get the district out of its financial difficulties. School officials say they'll save an average of $439,000 for every school they close. A citizens committee has recommended closing 12 buildings. The district says that they will save about $4.2 million a year. But those figures don't include the cost to close the buildings and to renovate closed schools to accommodate new programs. Although a large portion of the savings is expected to come from having fewer principals and administrators on the payroll, the estimates don't allow for the possibility that some schools that remain open may need assistant principals to handle more students.
Scientists say Mount St. Helens shot a steam and ash plume at least 16,000 feet into the air after a large rock fall from the lava dome in the volcano's crater. Pilots reported the plume rose yesterday between 16,000 and 20,000 feet in the air. Scientists say the rockfall coincided with a magnitude 3.0 earthquake shortly after 9 a.m. yesterday at the mountain. A scientist told the Columbia newspaper that they don't know how much steam and how much ash there was. Lava has continued to push into the crater since the nearly 8,400-foot mountain reawakened with a drum fire of low-level seismic activity in September 2004. The crater was formed by the volcano's deadly May 1980 eruption that killed 57 people.
Hundreds of Los Angeles residents visited the 14-acre South Central Farm this weekend to buy fresh produce from the families that tend the nation's largest urban farm. The roughly 350 farmers are facing a court-ordered eviction, but continue trying to save the land from developer Ralph Horowitz, who they say purchased it in a secret backroom deal with the city of L.A. Andrea Rodriguez has been farming a plot for 10 years. She spent Sunday making quesadillas and explains why the farm is important to her.
The important thing is that for our children, well, when you go to the supermarket, the foods are frozen, and the ones here are nutritious. We're here collaborating to help, to be able to save the land. And it's important for the nutrition of our children and all of us. What we think is that people need to help us and need to give their support. That's what we want, for every single person to donate a dollar and help save this.
That was Andrea Rodriguez speaking from the South Central Farm in Los Angeles, soon to be shut down by a developer.
In an act of mass civil disobedience, Native American residents, local and out-of-state supporters, allegedly trespassed into a nuclear testing site on the former Nevada Proving Ground, just north of Las Vegas, celebrating the cancellation of what would have been the largest conventional bomb blast on record. FSRN's Paige Gitz reports from Mercury, Nevada.
70 were arrested in Nevada this weekend as hundreds gathered on a desert road through the ancestral lands of the Western Shoshone Nation. They were protesting the Defense Department's plan to detonate 700 tons of explosives at the Nevada test site. The bomb would have exploded 1.4 million pounds of fuel oil and fertilizer, nearly 300 times the amount used in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. But as the reservation was filling up with protesters Saturday, the DOD announced the plan had been put on hold indefinitely. Known as the Divine Strike, the blast would have created a mushroom cloud 2 miles high across Nevada, releasing radioactive dust left from nearly half a century of nuclear tests. Corbin Harney is a Western Shoshone elder and the founder of the Shandahai Network.
We're concerned for the younger generation, for all the living things on this planet of ours, because we're seeing everything dying out. Animals are disappearing, birds are disappearing.
Arrests were made as supporters crossed through the open barbed wire gates that border the test site. But Christopher Sewell of the Western Shoshone Defense Project says both sides of the line are included in the 24 million acres of land promised to the Shoshone Nation in the 1863 Treaty of Ruby Valley.
They have the audacity to say, oh, it was taken over 100 years ago by gradual encroachment. But look across this country, you know, it's not like it's full of people. You know, the vast majority of land in Nevada is administered by the federal government. You know, over 85% of the land in Nevada is administered by the federal government. Under no U.S. law that I know of is gradual encroachment the law of the land, where you can just go and take somebody else's land like that.
In March, the United Nations ruled the federal occupation of the land was in violation of both international law and the 1863 treaty ratified by Congress and signed by then-President Ulysses S. Grant, land that is already covered with radioactive sand.
A good percentage of the energy comes from nuclear power. So if 25% of your energy comes from nuclear power, do you know where the waste from that nuclear reactor is going to go to? But you know it's going out west. It's going to the Shoshone people.
Tom Goldtooth is the executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. Because many environmental regulations don't apply to the land ceded to the 500 tribes left in the U.S., Goldtooth says they're often victims of environmental racism.
We feel that this government isn't protective of people of color, our native people. We have federal laws that are supposed to protect all people equally. And somehow people of color, poor people, indigenous people, it's our lands that are dumped on first. And if any of our lands are contaminated, it's our lands that are cleaned up last.
Chris Paris was one of 27 women arrested for crossing the line.
It's the people who are over there who are illegally trespassing upon land right now. There's an area over there that for 1,000 years no human being can go onto because they let off so many bombs that the ground is poisoned. And when Divine Strike hits the ground, it's going to put a mushroom cloud in the air toward Las Vegas, Utah, all of this land.
Chairperson of the Neth Valley Western Shoshone, Joe Kennedy, signed on to the lawsuit credited with pressuring the Defense Department to cancel the test.
I mean, Shoshone land's been bombed more than any other country in the world. There's been a lot of cancer rates up there. The animals, basically, stories that, you know, they were running off the base and their hair was falling out and they were dying.
The suit, filed in a Las Vegas federal court last month, also seeks compensation for both the Shoshone and other downwinders for damages caused by 928 nuclear bombs detonated at the Nevada test site between 1951 and 1993. The bombing was originally scheduled for June 2nd, but was postponed till the 23rd, and on Sunday was put on hold indefinitely as a result of the lawsuit. Since CNN reported the test was in preparation for a potential attack on underground bunkers in North Korea and Iran, the protesters say they have no doubt this isn't the last they've heard of the Divine Strike. Paige Getz, FSRN, Mercury, Nevada.
The U.S. Supreme Court today sided with the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office to limit whistleblowers' rights. In a 5-4 vote, justices said the nation's 20 million public employees do not have carte blanche free speech rights to disclose information about the government's inner workings. The L.A. County D.A. had appealed an appellate court ruling which held that prosecutor Richard Ceballos was constitutionally protected when he wrote a memo questioning whether a county sheriff's deputy lied in a search warrant affidavit. Ceballos had filed a lawsuit claiming he was demoted and denied a promotion for trying to expose the lie. An estimated 100 whistleblower retaliation lawsuits are filed each year.
Goldman Sachs Chairman and CEO Henry Paulson was nominated today to succeed John Snow as Treasury Secretary. Paulson, a supporter of tax cuts and strong dollar policies, will face the difficult task of dealing with the growing U.S. debt, as well as tracking international terrorist funding activities. Anastasia Nedatskaya reports from Washington, D.C.
Henry Paulson has been Chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs since May 1999. In addition to his Wall Street experience, he has served in the White House and in the Pentagon earlier in his career. Appointment of Paulson as the head of United States Treasury continues the tradition of service in government by Goldman Sachs chairman. John Corzine, Stephen Friedman, and Robert Rubin, all predecessors of Mr. Paulson at Goldman Sachs, left the company to serve in government. Corzine first served in the Senate and now is governor of New Jersey. Unlike Paulson, Corzine is a Democrat, as is another former Goldman CEO, Robert Rubin, who served as President Clinton's Treasury Secretary. Paulson joined Republican-leaning Wall Street counterparts, including Merrill Lynch's Stanley O'Neill, as a pioneer by raising at least $100,000 for Bush's 2004 re-election campaign. He is also a major supporter of the Bush administration's economic policy, including tax cuts.
At a critical time in our country's economic history, you recognized the need for tax relief to lower the marginal rates on work, risk-taking, savings, and investment. Those policies lie at the heart of the recovery we're now enjoying, which has also seen a dramatic increase in federal revenues. That surge in government receipts, along with the strict control on spending that you've advocated, are putting us on a path to not only meet your deficit reduction target, but to do so ahead of schedule.
As the president revealed in today's nomination speech made at the White House's Rose Garden, he has high expectations in regard to Paulson's ability to manage the country's burgeoning budget deficit.
The tax relief we delivered has helped set off the economic expansion that we're seeing today. And one of Hank's most important responsibilities will be to build on this success by working with Congress to maintain a pro-growth, low-tax environment. Hank also understands that the government should spend the taxpayers' money wisely or not at all. He will work closely with Congress to help restrain the spending appetite of the federal government and keep us on track to meet our goal of cutting the deficit in half by 2009.
Another policy that Paulson supports is strong dollar. According to Dean Baker from the Center for Economic Policy Research, this reflects the interests of Wall Street.
Choosing Wall Street persons, you know, presumably you're very deferential to the interests of the financial community, which I'm concerned about because I think very often the interests of the financial community could be antithetical to the economy as a whole. And, you know, strong dollar policy being a good example. General Motors is not happy to hear that we're going to have a strong dollar policy because it's going to make it that much harder for them to compete with imported cars. It's a policy that may be good for the financial community. It's not good for industrial companies, and I'd say it's certainly not good for workers in the United States.
Analysts stress that Paulson's vast experience with international financial markets will be an asset, since currently the U.S. is highly dependent on foreign investment. It is believed that Paulson's appointment is explained by the need for a new spokesman for Bush's economic record in times when the president is suffering from very low approval ratings. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezdytskaya in Washington, D.C.
Last Friday, the Senate approved the promotion of General Michael Hayden from Deputy Director of National Intelligence under John Negroponte, the director to Director of CIA. But why did Hayden's predecessor, Porter Goss, last only 19 months? And is there reason to expect Hayden to fare better? KBOO reporter Michael Gene Horowitz recently phoned intelligence scholar Dr. Jeffrey T. Richelson in Los Angeles for the evidence.
After receiving a doctorate from the University of Rochester in 1975, Jeffrey T. Richelson taught political science at American University, New York University, and the University of Texas. Now based in Los Angeles, the scholar no longer requires an academic position, because for the past 16 years, leading publishers like Oxford, HarperCollins, and Norton have been publishing his popular studies of satellite intelligence, weapons intelligence, and intelligence history, while the National Security Archive in Washington retains him to file several weekly briefings on national security. With General Hayden moving into Porter Goss's office this week, I invited Richelson to issue a post-mortem on Goss's tenure. Some observers say the former legislator alienated CIA veterans by attempting to purge the agency of critics of administration policy. But Richelson argues it wasn't Goss's orders that sunk him. It was the way they came down.
Goss surrounded himself with a number of aides that he brought with him. They were referred to as the Gosslings. And this is a problem that's occurred in several past cases, where they come over, they bring a lot of their own personal assistance. But when you completely surround yourselves with such people, there often is a problem in your relation with the rest of the agency. And from what I've read, these aides had poor relations with senior CIA people.
And no sooner did John Negroponte pioneer his new National Intelligence Directory last year than he began to raid CIA to broaden the analytic capability of his office's burgeoning counterterrorism and counterproliferation centers. The result?
There was apparently conflict between Goss and Negroponte over the question of transferring analysts from CIA to the DNI's office. One question that remains unresolved is where over the next decade the bulk of national intelligence analysis will be done, whether it'll still be in the CIA or whether it will gradually shift over more heavily to the DNI's office.
Yet because General Hayden has been Negroponte's deputy for the past year, Richardson wonders
how much fight he might give DNI with regard to the shift in analysts. How will he interact with Negroponte now that he's over at CIA? Will he basically, in some ways, continue to be Negroponte's deputy and always be on the same page with him, or will he give him a battle on issues like that?
The outcome would be significant if, as the New York Sun reported earlier this month, Negroponte and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld favor more ambitious covert operations than the CIA traditionally has supported. Richelson's scholarship is so rigorous, I couldn't resist also learning his take on the CIA's false prediction of WMD in Iraq, even though it occurred on George Tenet's watch. Some former agents argue the agency knew better, but that Vice President Cheney forced analysts to ignore and twist facts. But Richardson contends the agency didn't need Cheney to reach the wrong conclusion.
There was an analyst in the Weapons Intelligence, Nonproliferation, and Arms Control Center, and he was convinced that the purchase of aluminum tubes by Iraq was evidence that they were actually planning to reconstitute their nuclear program. He believed these aluminum tubes would be used in centrifuges. And his position became the agency position, and the agency position became the intelligence community's position.
As it turned out, the tubes weren't earmarked for centrifuges at all.
Eventually, the Energy Department's Office of Intelligence found that they fit in perfectly with a rocket program the Iraqis had.
You might wonder how much taxpayers are paying for this sort of bungling. Although intelligence budgets are secret, observers estimate the total U.S. intelligence dole at 40-something billion annually. As for the CIA's portion,
it wouldn't be out of line to expect it would be $5 to $6 billion. Most of the overall intelligence budget is going to NSA and the National Reconnaissance Office and a variety of other agencies. So most of the budget is certainly not in CIA.
Jeff Richelson's new history of U.S. nuclear intelligence, Spying on the Bomb, is available at bookstores. For KBOO National News, this is Michael Gene Horowitz.
Questions still remain over the legality of the FBI's raid on the office of Democratic Congressman William Jefferson. It marked the first time the FBI has ever raided the office of a sitting member of Congress. Last week, House Speaker Dennis Hastert and other lawmakers demanded that any materials seized in the raid be returned to the congressman, who was under investigation for bribery. However, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and FBI Director Robert Mueller have defended the raid. According to the press accounts, Gonzalez, Mueller, and Gonzalez's deputy, Paul McNulty, signaled to the White House that they would resign before returning seized evidence in the bribery investigation. Last week, President Bush ordered that the Jefferson materials be sealed for 45 days while justice officials and House lawmakers work out their differences.
A ruling today from the European Union's Court of Justice will make it illegal for airlines to give the U.S. personal information about transatlantic air passengers traveling to the U.S. under current arrangements. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Since 2004, European airline companies have been obliged by the U.S. to send them 34 separate pieces of information about passengers flying to the U.S., no less than 15 minutes before takeoff. Failure to do this could result in a $6,000 fine per passenger and refusal to grant the right to land. The court ruled today the decision by the body that represents national governments, the Council of Ministers, to sign the agreement had lacked an adequate legal basis. It also ruled that the US did not provide adequate protection for air passengers' privacy. The ruling will come into force later this year. And while some are heralding this as a victory for privacy rights and the European Parliament, others are cautioning that negotiations for replacement agreements may now begin with individual governments. And that, they say, may prove to be worse than the passenger information sharing deal outlawed today. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The New York Times reports the Pentagon is pressing Congress to approve the development of a global strike missile that would enable the United States to carry out non-nuclear missile strikes against any target in the world within an hour. However, critics say the weapon could lead to an accidental nuclear war. That's because the Pentagon plans to deploy the non-nuclear warhead atop the submarine-launched Trident II missile. The same submarine that carry nuclear Trident II missiles would also carry the non-nuclear version. Critics say it could be hard for other countries, such as Russia, to determine if a missile coming out a Trident submarine was conventional or nuclear.
8 illegal immigrants arrested under Arizona's new and controversial anti-smuggling law pleaded guilty to reduced charges today. The law makes it a state crime to smuggle immigrants. And under a legal opinion by Maricopa County Attorney Andrew Thomas, immigrants suspected of hiring smugglers to cross into Arizona from Mexico can be charged as conspirators to the crime. The Maricopa County Sheriff's Office is the only law enforcement agency in Arizona to target illegal immigrants under the law, not just smugglers. Under the plea deal accepted today by the 8 defendants, each was placed on 2 years probation and agreed to be deported to Mexico. One attorney says the men face up to 6 years in prison if they return again illegally.
South Dakota may be a step closer to a statewide vote on abortion. An abortion rights group has submitted petitions with more than twice the number of signatures needed to ask voters to repeal the state's sweeping abortion ban. South Dakota lawmakers earlier this year invited a constitutional challenge by passing the strictest abortion law in the nation. The law, set to take effect July 1st, would criminalize all abortions except those necessary to save a woman's life. There are no exceptions for rape or incest. The South Dakota Campaign for Healthy Families says it turned in more than 38,000 signatures to petition for a statewide referendum. The South Dakota Secretary of State's office will check the validity of the signatures and determine whether the measure qualifies for the ballot. 17,000 valid signatures are needed to get in on the ballot.
Military investigators have determined that U.S. Marines wantonly killed unarmed Iraqi citizens, civilians, including women and children, in the city of Haditha last November. An internal investigation determined that the Marines fatally shot as many as 24 Iraqis and then tried to cover up the killings. One 10-year-old Iraqi girl said she watched Marines kill her mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, 4-year-old cousin, and 2 uncles. The incident is being compared to the massacre in My Lai during the Vietnam War. Several Marines involved in the killing are now being held in Camp Pendleton Bragg in California. At least one Marine has spoken to the media about what he witnessed. Lance Corporal Roel Ryan Briones told the Los Angeles Times he was not involved in the killings but took photographs and helped remove the dead bodies. Briones said they ranged from little babies to adult males and females.
The current time is 5:33, and now time for another daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When the GOP Senate leader, Bill Frist, recently proposed that Uncle Sam send $100 to every American family as a way to assuage public anger over skyrocketing gasoline prices, he was hooted down by his fellow Republicans, who labeled the giveaway a bribe, an insult, and stupid. But then, only days later, Frist and the Republicans rammed yet another tax cut boondoggle through Congress, which will result in Uncle Sam giving an average of $42,700 to each and every American millionaire. So far, there have been no reports of millionaires feeling insulted. Indeed, Speaker Denny Hastert called this bill a day of celebration for the American people. And George W. called the vote an important step to continue to help hard-working Americans. Well, yeah, if you're one of the 0.1% of Americans who are millionaires, finding an extra $42K in your pocket can be of some help and is certainly a cause for celebration. You could buy 42 bottles of Dom Perignon's best champagne, for example, and have a heck of a celebration. But as far as you hardworking folks, forget it. Let's say you make under $30,000 a year, which is the income level of nearly half of the American people. What's your cut from the GOP's big tax bonanza? It will average a whopping, get ready to be excited, $5. It's hard to celebrate large on that. The GOP's giveaway is a blatant bribe being paid to its core political base of rich families. Meanwhile, it will take $70 billion out of our public treasury during the next 2 years. That's money that'll go to champagne parties rather than to health care, education, parks, and other programs that America's hardworking folks really need. This is Jim Hightower saying, when Bush, Frist, and Hastert talk about the American people, they mean millionaires like themselves, not you. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Raunch and Liberation, a production of the Women's International News Gathering Service, followed by Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Amanda's Jam Corner. The weather, perfect for ducks and garden plants. Warm and rainy through the week in the Willamette Valley, highs above 70. In the Columbia Gorge, much more sun and much less rain, moving towards 80. Rain on Thursday. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Burundi's government has begun peace talks with the only active rebel group still outside a power-sharing agreement. The Hutu National Liberation Forces remains the only rebel group not to have taken part in peace deals as the country emerges from more than a decade of ethnic clashes between majority Hutus and minority Tutsi. A ceasefire was signed by the FNL last year but broke down after 1 week. Around 300,000 people were killed in the civil war.
In Moscow, over 1,000 police officers broke up the city's first-ever gay pride march this past weekend. Up to 100 people were arrested, including the lead organizer of the march. Riot police dragged march participants away as they attempted to speak with the press. One gay rights activist was beaten by a gang of counter-protesters while he was giving a televised interview. Moscow's mayor, Yuri Luskov, had banned the march, citing moral reasons. An official from Human Rights Watch said the police were encouraging skinheads to attack gay men and lesbians participating in the march. Prior to the event, organizer Nikolai Alexeyev outlined why a gay pride march was needed in Russia.
Dozens of young people armed with baseball bats have clashed with police in Paris suburb, raising fears of riots. The clashes started late Monday night in the town of Montfermeil. Before police dispersed the crowd early Tuesday, Montfermeil is near Clichy-sous-Bois, where riots erupted late last year following the accidental deaths of two North African teenagers who had been hiding from police in an electricity substation. Confrontation followed between police and young people, mainly from North Africa communities and the northeastern suburb.
The death toll caused by the 5.9 magnitude earthquake in Yogyakarta in central Java, Indonesia, on Saturday morning has reached nearly 7,000. Almost 100,000 buildings have been destroyed, in and around 20,000 people were injured. From the disaster site in Yogyakarta, Maggie Margiono reports.
It's been 4 days since the quake destroyed Yogyakarta and central Java, and there are still many bodies believed to be buried in the rubble. The evacuation process has faced major difficulties with high daily rainfall and not enough tents for survivors. Sarjono is a quake survivor.
We received aid from the community, not from the government. We got half a kilogram of rice for 35 and 4 boxes of instant noodles as well as 4 packs of milk, all for 35 families.
Imam Parwadi, the head of the disaster response unit at Klaten, the second most badly hit area, said the government aid distribution process takes a long time.
The aid is distributed in many steps. First, supplies are delivered to regencies within a province, then to sub-regencies, then to villages, and finally to each camp.
The lack of food and tents has spurred some to loot supplies among fellow survivors. Priyono is living in one of the tent cities.
The weather is so bad, so we really need tents. Since I do not have a tent for my family, I stole this one. I stole it yesterday. This is not mine.
Waiwanto, one of the volunteers, says that in addition to tents, the survivors need medicines. The existing hospitals in Yogyakarta, Klaten, and surrounding cities cannot accommodate 20,000 injured.
What they really need are tents and medicine. Medicine like pills and balsam are very needed. As they live outdoors, many people are now falling ill.
Jogja is known as the education city. However, today, not many school and campuses are in operation. Around 800 schools have been destroyed. The students that should have taken their national exams this week have to go to the streets to ask for money. Their families have nothing left. Fortunately, the Minister of Education has exempted students from taking the exam. Bambang Sudibyo is Indonesian Minister of Education.
The exams can be postponed. They have 1.5 months to defer the exams. It's impossible for them to administer the joint exam now. The students are also still traumatized by what happened on Saturday.
Today, Yogyakarta Airport is operating for helicopter and cargo aircraft service, even though it is still badly damaged. The opening of the airport has helped to speed up aid distribution. Reading for Maggie Margiono in Jakarta, I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News.
An estimated 200,000 people are homeless from this weekend's earthquake on Java, Indonesia. And a Mercy Corps assessment team has determined that temporary shelters is a top priority for devastated communities. The magnitude 6.3 earthquake this weekend killed nearly 5,700 people and injured thousands more. Portland-based Mercy Corps is at the scene of the devastation. Mercy Corps works amid disasters, conflicts, and chronic poverty and instability to unleash the potential of people who can win against impossible odds. Since 1997, Mercy Corps has provided $1 billion in assistance to people in 82 nations. To donate, go to www.mercycorps.org.
Indonesia is to repay all of its debt to the International Monetary Fund by the end of 2008. The governor of the country's national bank said the government would pay half of its amount, $8 billion debt, this year and the rest next year. Analysts believe damage caused by the weekend's earthquake could cost the country up to $100 million. Abdullah said the Indonesian economy was strong enough for the country to repay almost $4 billion of the debts within weeks. Indonesia's debts to the IMF arose during the late 1990s to help it cope with the Asian economic crisis.
The eastern Indian state of Bihar has created a turning point in Indian electoral politics by reserving 50% of their seats for women in its village councils. A debate to reserve at least 33% of the legislative seats for women on both provincial and federal levels had been raging for over a decade in the country. P.C. Dubney reports from Bihar, India.
Now some 130,500 women are slated to head various village council offices in the state. This would not only empower women tremendously, but equally revolutionize the social psyche and structure in the state, where women would be treated as equal partners in combating the banes of poverty and illiteracy. The idea of women holding seats in the village council is revolutionary. Women would finally have a say in how and where to spend some 50,000 million rupees annually earmarked for rural development in the state. Tileshwar Rai, an octogenarian sociologist, says now the myth that women would not be able to cope with the vagaries of current political culture of male dominance is withering. Women are proving to be better politicians, more human, and committed to social welfare than men. He claims even women are discerning their now newfound metal. This will radically change their traditional psyche of subservience to males into that of self-assertion and self-esteem.
They feel that they are also somebody. I visualize that India is moving towards the real democracy.
Manjula Ojha, a female candidate for village council chief, hails from a rich and well-educated family. She enjoyed little leeway in her patriarchal family. Manjula says that women in council has not only revolutionized the tradition of women in Bihar, but has also won over orthodox males to let their women step out of their home and mingle with other village women and men.
Seeing me on the campaign trail, even husbands of those women who have never stepped out of homes encourage them to join me. They say, if a woman of a family like mine is moving in the village, why can't others do the same?
Sister Alice, a Catholic nun engaged in the rural women empowerment program, says though the 50% reservation for women in village councils is a radical phenomenon, it will take years for women to really discern their potentials and wiggle out of the cocoons of the male hegemony.
Maybe after 3 to 4 years, they will be coming out of their bondage.
Samir Bajpayee, a media analyst, further says that women commanding the offices of people's welfare would certainly whittle the epidemic of corruption in a poor state like Bihar, where the annual per capita income is barely $100.
They live in a family ambiance. They have the culture that works in just ways. So it will certainly help lessen corruption compared to their male counterparts.
Manjula Ojha believes if women get similar quotas for women in the state and national legislatures too, the country would turn for the better.
This will allow women to pitch in the development of the country to the hilt.
Josh Kalapura, director of Bihar Social Institute, which is engaged in monitoring the current village council polls, says that in a state like Bihar, where women are cursed with barely 40% literacy and other social discrimination, it will set a good precedence if they are entrusted with the local governance and succeed in their mission.
Bihar will show the way if local governance is fully managed or women take part in local governance in a bigger way in Bihar, such a backward state as it is. It will be a model.
I am PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News in Patna, Bihar.
The Indian government's move to increase quotas for India's lower castes at the country's public universities to nearly 50% is facing strong protests from upper caste students and professionals. Protests by doctors have crippled the medical services in many cities. Binu Alex reports.
India's Supreme Court today issued an ultimatum to striking doctors and medical students to end their 18-day-old strike or face contempt of court charges. The medical fraternity is protesting against a federal government plan to increase college quotas for students from lower castes. The new quota regime plans to reserve nearly half of state-funded professional college places for lower caste students as of next year. It will leave less than 50% for those who compete on the basis of merit, which doctors are from the upper caste say is the main reason for the strike. The strike has badly affected health services in all government-run hospitals across the country, leaving many patients without medical aid. From Ahmedabad, India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
UN peacekeepers in the Democratic Republic of the Congo continue searching for 7 Nepalese peacekeepers who are missing after a clash with militias which took the life of another peacekeeper. UN troops involved in the world's largest peacekeeping operation are trying to disarm militias in the volatile eastern DRC ahead of crucial presidential elections on July 30th. Joshua Kwalampa reports from neighboring Uganda.
The clash occurred in the northern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. A statement from the UN Observer Mission in Congo, MONUC, says the clash occurred as UN troops were helping government forces during the operation against militias that plagued this part of the country. 3 Nepalese soldiers were wounded during the incident and another died in combat. 7 others are missing after losing contact with their unit. To date, over 14,000 other militias in the region have already been disarmed through the DDR program. A total of 12 MONUC peacekeepers have died on duty since the beginning of this year. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting.
An Israeli jet fighter and a special army unit attacked the northern part of the Gaza Strip, killing four and injured several others in the early hours of Tuesday morning. It represents the first confirmed Israeli incursion into Gaza since its withdrawal in September of 2005. In the West Bank, the Israeli army invaded several cities and killed at least three today. This as Israel's interior minister has warned four Palestinian Authority officials to either quit or be expelled from Jerusalem, Manar Jibrin reports.
Palestinian Minister of Jerusalem Affairs Khaled Abu Arafa and three Hamas members of parliament were told by Israeli authorities to either leave their positions or be expelled from East Jerusalem, giving them 30 days to decide on the ultimatum. One of those summoned, legislator Muhammad Totah, said the move is part of a systematic plan to expel Palestinians from Jerusalem and is also meant to pressure the Palestinian government.
This move is meant to pressure the new Palestinian government and to tighten the siege imposed on the Palestinian people. I believe the embargo imposed on the Palestinians by Europe and the United States gave Israel a justification to take this move.
Israel bans all Palestinian political activities in East Jerusalem, which was occupied in June of 1967. For Afasaran from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
At least 42 people have been injured by three blasts on a town in southern Ethiopia. The simultaneously blasts hit a hotel and two restaurants in Jijinga, southeast of the capital, Addis Ababa. It is not known who is behind the attacks. The country has experienced more than a dozen blasts since the beginning of the year. At least four people were killed and 40 others wounded in nine explosions earlier this month in Addis Ababa. Officials have variously blamed separatist rebels, Eritrea, Somalia Muslim extremists, and opposition groups. Political tension has been high in Ethiopia since disputed elections last year led to opposition protests that turned violent.
That's the KVU Evening News for Tuesday, May 30th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kvu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264 AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock Rivas. Our assistant producer is Lisa Loving. Tonight's audio editor is Angela Hancock Rivas. Special thanks to reporters Stephanie Potter and Michael Horowitz. Our engineer is Judy Festal. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Jo Sonia Watson.
And I'm Doug Guidi. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. And at 7:30 on Locust Focus Talk Radio, Barbara Bernstein hosts a preview of Oil, Water, and Oregon Symposium. Her guests include Ilahi Lectures Director Peter Schoonmaker and Brian Rocher, CEO of New Seasons Market. They'll discuss localism and sustainability in business practices, growing and eating food, as well as other energy and water issues that affect our region. At 9, Parafagering interviews Antonia Hujas, the author of The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. They'll discuss the Bush administration, the highest oil profits in world corporate history, and the future of Iraq. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller continues It Is Happening Here, his year-long look at characteristics of fascism in U.S. government and society. He and his guest, Avis Jones DeWeaver, Director of Poverty, Education, and Social Justice Programs at the Institute for Women's Policy Research, will discuss rampant sexism. At 10:30, Will Seaman interviews John Miller, National Coordinator of the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network, about the current crisis in East Timor. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 30th of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A federal appeals court has dealt another setback to former leaders of the Sac and Fox tribe of the Mississippi of Iowa, also known as the Meskwaki. Pat Blank reports.
A three-judge panel with the U.S. 8th Circuit Court of Appeals has rejected a request that their case be reheard by the full court. The leaders, who were ousted in 2003, insist their replacements lack legitimacy. They've tried fighting the decision in the federal courts for 3 years, after the Meskwaki Tribal Council and its chair were ousted by a second set of leaders. Back then, that infighting led to a 7-month shutdown of the Meskwaki Casino, resulting in the loss of millions of dollars. The dispute was settled after a series of elections overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. In March of this year, a three-judge panel affirmed a lower court ruling that they lacked the jurisdiction to intervene. The judges said the power struggle was a tribal matter that should have been settled by the tribe's own leaders. And in this latest decision, the Federal Appeals Court agrees with the lower court. It's unclear if this is the end of the legal action or if it will be referred to the U.S. Supreme Court. In Cedar Falls, Iowa, this is Pat Blank.
In Alaska, the Manakotik School near Dillingham recently hosted school children and elders from all over the Southwest region in the second annual spring celebration of Yupik culture. KDLG's Jody Seitz has details.
The village of Manakotik, just a few short miles as the crow flies from Dillingham, feels like another country. Yupik on the VHF radio and a long, bumpy ride clattering over potholed roads the city can't afford to keep free. The quiet of the school is a welcome relief. For the festival, instead of the usual teachers in their classrooms, students are gathered around elders, learning traditional crafts, stories, and skills. An elderly woman with a very tanned face and a big, wide smile, Anuska Nanaluk, sits on a low chair, sewing threads of long, blonde beech grass into a spiral that will become a basket.
Now watch for tea.
She says the best grasses are the shorter ones with a purple base. Some have been turned into threads and sewn into curled spirals. Students rotate between classes on survival, sewing, beading, storytelling, learning skills from a time when something as simple as a piece of string could provide hours of entertainment. We crowd into a classroom where everyone is trying to make shapes from the circles of string. Learning from two old friends, Henry Alakiak of Manakotik and Nick Gumlitpuk of Nustuyahok. Anisha Lomak interprets as they tell how to predict the weather, making a line of mountains from the circle of string.
You could see the mountains and the weather is going to be good.
Enrican speaks some English, and he tries out a little string trick on Lane Bartman, wrapping his finger with string. But Bartman is ready for him and thrusts forward a hand with most of the first finger missing, a birth defect he's learned to live and joke with.
Oh, cut them off already.
But the day isn't all fun and games. There's some serious advice for boys and separately for girls. Lena Andrew is in her 80s. Exhausted, she naps, head on her chest, after giving her message to the girls.
She said to love everybody you see, strangers, just anybody, and then she advised us that we have to love even the orphans, kids without parents, feed them, love them, clothe them, so that we could face tomorrow.
I'm Jody Seitz.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska.